Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of Legion of News is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News!
High atop the Milkpacking District in the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. This, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all-important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor, who is, even now as I speak these words to you, preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
Tacoma teachers defy court orders and continue their strike. A Portland man is carjacked after responding to a Craigslist ad. And the southwestern United States sees mysterious lights in the sky.
As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, pay heed for this is Legion of News.
Good afternoon. I'm Dawn Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Thursday, September 15th, 2011. A man responding to a Craigslist ad about an iPhone for sale said he was carjacked in Northeast Portland on Wednesday night. The victim, a 45-year-old man, told police he agreed to meet the man selling the iPhone at the Albertsons parking lot, located at the intersection of Northeast Cully Boulevard and Prescott Street. The man said that when he arrived and unlocked his car door, the suspect quickly pushed his way into the car and pointed a gun at him. Sergeant Pete Simpson with Portland Police Bureau said the suspect demanded money from the victim, but the victim moved over to the passenger side of the car before opening the passenger door and fleeing the car.
Carefully, you'll get a die phone. Ice to meet you. Come on, just roll with it.
Okay. The suspect drove away in the victim's car and was last seen driving northbound on Northeast Cully Boulevard. The suspect was described as a light-skinned black man in his late teens or early 20s, around 5'7" tall with a thin build, hair pulled back into a ponytail-type bun, and tattoos on his neck. Wearing a light gray hooded shirt, the stolen vehicle was a silver 2011 Chevrolet Aveo four-door with California license plate 6NPE035.
Do you suppose there's somebody at the police department who, when the report comes in and it's a white man who's committed a crime, they go, well, that's a mistake. They must mean a light-skinned black man. Let me just change that. All right. Well, fantastic.
In Portland, though, considering how, you know, odds are still, I think, pretty good that it's going to be a white man doing the crime because, you know.
Because look at us.
Well, yeah. Our history in the city of Portland has been to try and, you know, keep the numbers of brown-skinned people down.
I myself am for more white-on-white crime, just to sort of, you know, just for empathy's sake, you know, just so we can sort of, you know, because that way we can, you know, so we can walk a mile in our brother's shoes.
I think more Asians should do crimes, really, because it'll just confuse everyone.
They'd be really good at it, too. They'd be the most efficient criminals. I mean, because,
good planners, those people.
I'm just saying, you know, and not just embezzlement, you know, not just math crimes. I mean, there's all kinds of, more than just carrying the one.
Plus, they all know that crazy kung fu.
Exactly.
Every last one of them.
Hello, you're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. It is Thursday, September 15th, 2011. Thank you for joining us. Coming up later on the hour, we got your science news, also your entertainment on the science news. Science on the March and entertainment news coming up at the bottom of the hour and at 12:45. Next hour, the Rick Emerson radio program at rickemersonshow.com. Here is Don Taylor.
Teachers in Tacoma, Washington, defied a court order
teachers.
And continued to strike on Thursday, forcing the school district to cancel classes for some 28,000 students who have been out of school all week.
This is that sound you were talking about.
Yeah.
What date was this originally? What day was this sound from?
This was 2 days ago. That I think it would have been Tuesday.
Maybe 13th?
Yeah, I think
all
so.
Right. All right, I should have
so,
that.
I don't actually have the copy on that, so I'm not even really sure what the sound is.
Well, we'll just make up a context.
So yeah, I'll just pause at some point, and you'll...
A guy had this to say about that.
Right, exactly. So the teachers in Tacoma defied the court order, continued to strike today, forcing the school district to cancel classes for some 28,000 students who have been out of school all week. Teachers Union spokesman Rich Wood said the vast majority decided to keep striking. They believe strongly in what they're doing. The school board is not listening. A Washington State court judge on Wednesday issued a temporary restraining order and ordered the schools to reopen immediately after the Tacoma School District took the striking teachers and the Tacoma Education Association Union to court. Wood said it was not yet clear how many teachers continued the protest or what sanctions they could face for keeping the strike going. A meeting of union members and new negotiations between union leadership and the school was expected to take place today, and that would determine if the state strike will continue.
That's what Tacoma needs, is less education.
So here's a guy saying something about something.
87% of our people.
87% of our people say we need to make a change.
I really would rather not strike.
Okay, then.
That might have been from American Idol, though. I'm not sure.
That's true. After Wednesday's ruling, Superior Court Judge Brian Chushkoff, District Superintendent Art Jarvis, said he expected teachers to return to work while the union and school district continued stalled contract negotiations. A hearing had already been scheduled for Friday to ensure the union complies with the judge's order. Chushkoff also ordered more hearings to be held on the legality of the strike and stalled negotiations. Attorneys for the school district argued that since teachers are state employees, they do not have the right to strike.
Also, like, nobody in the country has a job, so you just look like a dick if you're refusing to go to the job you have.
Well, kind of, yeah.
I'm just saying.
There's a school district attorney? Okay.
Well,
an attorney for the school district.
Yes.
Okay. Sharon McMinimy wrote in the lawsuit that if the two-day-old strike continues indefinitely, the protest could harm students, particularly children with disabilities, low-income pupils who rely on meals provided at the schools, and seniors who are applying to college next year.
Out of curiosity, what did you think school district attorney meant?
I don't know. Well, you hear the word district attorney, and you hear the word school district.
Oh, like it was a trainee?
But you don't usually hear school district attorney. So the combination just confused my brain for a moment.
Okay.
She also said students in Tacoma under the Constitution are entitled to an education.
I don't think that's necessarily sure that that's true.
In the Constitution.
Maybe. I don't believe so.
Anyway, here's somebody else saying something else, I think.
And I'll be walking the picket line tomorrow instead of teaching class tomorrow.
So now we're going to go make our signs and we'll be on the line at 6 in the morning.
I have a daughter that's a senior in high school and she's not happy to not be back at school. And we're not looking forward to striking. We want to be back in the classroom with the kids.
Don't eat me.
Tyler Firkins, the attorney for the teachers union, whom I am only quoting here because I wanted to say the words Tyler Firkins, said the school district is not negotiating in good faith. And if the strike continues, students could make up the missed time later. What they're saying is that the school year is immovable, can't be changed under any circumstances. That is not correct, Perkins says. Whether my child misses a week or two, it's not going to affect her education, Perkins said of his daughter, who attends classes at a Tacoma public school.
No, we can all just go to summer school. I mean, let's be honest. Like, 90% of those kids are headed for summer school anyway, one way or the other. I mean, it's just...
And by summer school, you mean dealing drugs behind the Piggly Wiggly.
I mean pregnant school. That's what I mean.
Pregnant school, too, the reality show.
Schools for sluts and knife wielders. That's really what those kids go to.
Tacoma.
Yeah. You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Don't forget, you can get this program later on the day via iTunes or as a direct MP3 download here at Cascadia.fm or at legionofnews.com. Here is Don Taylor.
An alert postman who had returned from vacation and noticed the unusually overflowing mailbox of an elderly Northeast Portland woman ended up saving her life. He knew that the woman, who lives alone, checked her mail daily. Sensing something was amiss, what with all of the mail not having been checked and all, he gathered some neighbors together. They knocked on the front door. No one answered, but they heard a faint voice. They went to the side of the home, to the bathroom window, and saw she was on the floor. The woman, neighbor... Okay, I'm about to read this, and I want you to know this came directly off the KGW website. The woman, neighbors reckon she's about 80 years old... asked for water.
neighbors reckoned. Do they even, is there
a woman,
at least...
comma, neighbors reckon she's about 80 years old, comma, asked for water.
So not only are we, quoting like Barney Gumble in this, but it's with commas.
Yes.
Not a dash, not an M dash.
No, it's a grammatically correct sentence. It's just, it's a news story that says neighbors reckon.
But it's not even grammatically correct because they shouldn't be commas.
Sure it would.
No, it would be dashes because it's a thought. It is a separate, it's a sub-thought.
Well, M dashes and commas can be interchangeable in some.
But not in this situation.
It should be M dashes. But many editors in journalism, as Mike Russell discovered, many newspaper and news editors don't really care for the M dash for some reason.
Well, those people can eat a big bag of balls is what they can do.
They can. But I would like to
those
say...
Those people, and there are a lot of them,
kudos,
can eat a big bag of balls.
Kudos to you, KGW, for once again saying, writing something in a professional capacity like, neighbors reckon she's about 80 years old.
This is sort of us in a nutshell, though, because you go right after the fact that they're talking like cornpone idiots, and I'm all about,
you're all about the
misuse of commas.
Anyway, it appeared she had been there for several days. She was taken to Portland Adventist Medical Center in fair condition, thanks to the alert postman.
Hey, here's a question that I have, though. So why is it called an M-dash? Is that M as in Montezuma? Like, is it M hyphen?
No, it's E-M dash.
Is it all one word?
But I believe that is indicating... I don't know where initially the M part comes from. It's to delineate the long dash from the short dash.
Is that one word? M dash?
I don't believe so. I believe it's M dash dash.
Wait a minute. Spell it for me.
E-M dash D-A-S-H.
That's interesting.
No, it's space in between? Okay, so Thomas Gill tells me it's a space.
Well, I'm looking it up here. Ah, here we go. M dash. No, it's two words.
Okay.
M dash. Let's see. M dash demarcates a break or thought or some similar interpolation stronger than the interpolation demarcated by parentheses. But they don't give a. They don't give an etymology for. Ah, no. Here we go. The term M-dash derives from its defined width of one M, which is the length expressed in points by which font sizes are typically specified.
Huh.
Thus, in 9-point type, I know everybody cares about this, an M is 9 points, an M, E-M, is 9 points wide, while the M of 24-point type is 24 points wide, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so there you go.
Well,
so from the size.
I will say, I cut my journalistic teeth under Mr. Mike Russell as my editor, and Mike Russell was quite had quite the fondness for the M dash.
As do I.
Well, the thing is, Mike not only had a fondness for the M dash, but he also tended to overuse the M dash. So I also learned to overuse the M dash.
There is no overuse of the M dash.
Oh, if you go back to some of my early my earlier work, go to like the DVD Journal and read, for example, my. My review of, say, The Sound of Music, you will see a gross overuse of M dashes. I really had to teach myself. And when Mike started to work for The Oregonian, interesting enough, the people at the copy desk started calling him M dash Russell.
That's funny. So. I'm going to start calling him that. Well, let me ask you this. And if you don't have a strong opinion, I swear to God, I'll call Mike Russell right now on the phone and ask him. Because we've done that before. We called him about your TV, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
And then we'll get back to actual news here, because otherwise it's just going to, like, devolve into being a Thursday way before it ought to. So when you're using the M-dash, how do you feel about the closed or open usage of it? Meaning, do you put a space on either side of the M-dash?
Yes, I put a space on either side.
Ah, see, so do I, but many people do not.
No.
Dicks at Oxford, they don't do that.
No. Also, I have a thing about these people who insist, and I've had... this is sad, I have had large, wonky arguments with people about this online. People get passionate about grammar and spelling things. Yeah. And that there are people who insist that it is still correct to do two spaces after a period. And that is from back when people were on typewriters, and they don't seem to understand. Word processes automatically give more space after a period, so you don't have to do that anymore. In fact, you shouldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, I don't do that, and it bothers me. The only time I do it is if I had to do this morning when I was...
But the pro space people, they will get so angry about it.
Yeah, well, they can die. They can die. They can die painfully and slowly and alone. Covered in rats. The only time I do that is
we are dorks.
If the previous sentence, if the sentence that I am leaving ends in other words, if there's going to be two sentences and it's like I'm using some abbreviation like EG or IE or something, or, you're ending with an abbreviation and then it becomes confusing. So
yes.
I do that for visual clarity sometimes. But other than that, it's one space. I think anything else is for a-holes
That's
and communists.
Right. Exactly.
That's right. All right. Asian criminals.
Do you do that? Thomas Gill does that.
Well, that's fine.
No, no, word processors automatically do that for you. Don't. Yes, they do. Yes, they do. You are wrong, Thomas Gill.
We're gonna have to.
He's actually wrong about something.
Seriously, I'm gonna ring a bell, okay. And we're gonna have to.
Let's do another story.
Don't make me play the Inuit throat singing.
Oh God, no. The string. No.
That's what's in store.
Okay. The streak of light that blazed across southwestern U.S. skies and stoked burning curiosity about the social across the social media landscape was probably just a tiny and bright meteor known as a fireball,
or
according to a NASA spokeswoman on Thursday. Virginia McGregor, a spokeswoman at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, called it a rarely seen and exciting treat for the legions of people who glanced to the heavens on Wednesday night. Law enforcement and media in Phoenix, Los Angeles, and Las Vegas were fielding calls of the reported sighting. It quickly became a hot topic on a number of social media websites, with most people asking, "Did you see that? What was it?" For all the millions of people that called, they can scratch that off their bucket list, McGregor said. They are very lucky to see a fireball.
And get a better bucket list while you're at it.
Seriously, that's it. I see fireball.
See light in sky.
Yeah. McGregor told CNN the object eyeballed in the sky on Wednesday night was probably the size of a baseball or a basketball based on description. Yes,
and they reckoned.
This you can blame on CNN. They said eyeballed. Based on descriptions reported to police across the internet, the fireball was a tiny chunk of an asteroid that became a meteor when it hit the atmosphere. While it probably incinerated before it reached the ground, it is not impossible that a pebble-sized meteorite survived the trip. NASA officials announced this week the now-defunct Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite, in addition, is expected to fall back to Earth in coming weeks. So if you saw things falling from the sky, it wasn't the satellite. That's going to happen later. There's still no word, though, on whether what was... Oh, yeah, when this thing was... I did just fall apart. Eventually, yes, they did figure out that it was, or they're lying to us, and they're saying that it was a tiny little fireball. High school student Kimberly Curto saw it when she was at her brother's football game.
I didn't know what it was at first. Like, I thought it was, like, a meteor, or, you know, like, everybody was pointing at it and screaming, and they thought it was a UFO or something.
pointing at it and screaming. And so, everybody at the football game, every person was pointing at it and screaming.
I hope that was true, and I hope there's footage of it.
That would be awesome.
That would be fantastic.
Well, she does say she caught the object on video.
I was still in my brother's football game, and I happened to look up and see this, like, circular object that was greenish-blue, like, just streaking across the sky.
So, wait, I missed it. Did they say what it was?
Yeah, they said it was a baseball-sized... You know, meteor.
Okay. It was a chunk of space rock.
It was a chunk of rock.
Okay. All
right. Or it was some of those aliens from Attack the Block coming into our atmosphere, and they are now wreaking havoc in our inner cities.
Which I have not yet seen.
Well, so. you should.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stephen Miles, a University of Minnesota bioethicist, got the ball rolling by saying he's going to give $1,000. $1,000. If medical records prove a girl suffered mental retardation after receiving a vaccine against HPV, as Representative Michelle Bachmann claimed during Monday's debate. She said she heard it straight from the girl's mother. Then Miles,
that's always the most reliable sources. Ask their parents
right.
to give you unbiased information about their children.
So this bioethicist guy said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you $1,000 if you can prove that this actually happened. Then his former boss, Art Kaplan, who is director of the University of Pennsylvania Center for Bioethics, said he would pay $10,000 to a charity of Bachmann's choice for any proof that this actually happened. These types of messages in this climate have the capacity to do enormous public health harm, Miles said. The woman, assuming she exists, put this claim into the public domain, and it's an extremely serious claim, and it deserves to be analyzed.
Well, parents just don't like to admit that sometimes God just gave them a bum seed. You know, like you just sometimes you get a potato chip and it's just green for no reason. There's just nothing. It doesn't mean it was a vaccine that did it.
Or, and I might be going out on a limb here.
Don't slander anyone.
Bachmann might have made it up.
Well, she probably didn't make it up. That's the thing. I have no doubt that the kid's mom said it. But parents, that's the thing. It's like parents always want to find some, and I understand why, but they always want to blame something, or they want there to be some cause. They don't like to, no one likes to admit that just occasionally things go wrong. And, you know, your kid comes out of the chute wonky.
My kid's retarded because she got a shot in her woo-woo.
Well, because you have to just...
And Michelle Bachmann says, yes, I will take this to the GOP debate.
Because the alternative is to admit that if you believe...
That your kids are retarded.
If you... I don't think anybody's...
Because of you.
I don't think anybody's disputing that. Nobody's saying it's because of the mom. What I'm saying is, if you believe in God, then you have to admit that God gave you a retarded child. And if you don't, then you have to face the cold, hard reality that one out of every X kids is just going to be born that way and there's nothing you can do about it. People don't like anything. I can see you opening your mouth to say something,
no.
But I will finish this.
No, please,
the
finish.
People don't like to acknowledge that the universe is just a place where a confluence of external factors can come together totally beyond your control and just give you a bad break or give your kid a bad break. The human mind has this desire to create an external cause for something that can be identified and therefore remedied and stopped from happening in the future. And you know what? It's not going to happen. You know, most things can't be helped, can't be avoided. And so I don't think Michelle Bachmann made it up at all. What I think is that Michelle Bachmann heard this and believed it wholesale without any sort of scientific underpinning or investigation into it. Just like people believe goddamn idiot Jenny McCarthy when she says that the autism thing is caused by vaccines, which has like, which the guy who initially made the alleged scientific claim has now retracted it and said that it just came out of his anus, from his anus to the page to Jenny McCarthy's brain.
I, on the other hand, have no problem believing that Michelle Bachmann just made
it. But the thing is, Michelle Bachmann doesn't need to do that because the world is full of idiots to feed her this information. And
yeah,
there's
but
no
she's
shortage.
She's crazy and has no problem just saying stuff that is nonsense.
But I don't think that she's crazy. I just think she's phenomenally dumb. And I think dumb and crazy are really indistinguishable. Look, she was crazy, she'd be much more interesting than she is. She's just dense.
Well, when she harshly criticized Rick Perry at Monday's debate over his executive order mandating the vaccination, many pundits described it as a point-scoring slam. Now it seems as though that might not be the case, as the claims not only led to widespread criticism from the medical community, but even conservative commentators are rushing to distance themselves from the lawmaker. Rush Limbaugh said Bachmann may have jumped the shark with her comment. I'm not sure that's... anyway, Mike Huckabee said, quote, "She went a little too far." Republican strategist Ed Rollins, who was Bachmann's campaign manager until earlier this month.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, he's one of the guys that bailed on her. Yeah.
I didn't know that he was ever working for her.
He characterized the comments as a mistake, according to The Hill. Rollins said it made sense to attack Perry on the executive order, but she made a mistake when she decided to talk about the side effects. Rollins said the quicker she admits she made a mistake, the better. Earlier, Bachmann tried to swat away any controversy, telling Sean Hannity, "I'm not a doctor. I am not a scientist. I am not a physician. All I was doing was reporting what this woman was reporting."
Glad she clarified that she's not a doctor.
Yeah, or a scientist.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah,
that's
so.
Great. Well done. The thing, it's like, you know, that woman, I think it was in the second show yesterday. This is in the Rick Emerson show we had. The woman who claimed that the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell was killing off birds.
Yes.
She's crazy. Michelle Bachmann's just dumb. That's the... Michelle Bachmann just believes whatever is sort of put in front of her on the table. I have a sound on this.
Oh, good. Do you?
Yes.
Was it...
It's in the news.
Oh.
In the news.
Oh, there we go. It's right here.
We can do it.
Yes, Bachmann... We can do it in the next one if you want to.
Well, it's up to you. I don't care.
No, we got lots of news. As a matter of fact, we have bad housing news. We don't have any bad housing news music, do we?
Wait, hold on. Let me see if I can, wait, hold on.
More bad housing news today. Rick Sharga with Realty Track says banks are trying to clear out their distressed property again.
Overall foreclosure activity was up by 7% compared to July, but the big news is that initial notices of default, the first stage of foreclosure, are up by 33% compared to the previous month.
Sharga says, however, he is trying to look on the bright side.
It sounds odd to say, but a 33% increase in new foreclosures is probably good news on balance for the housing market. We can't get the housing market back to a state of health until we work through this backlog of distressed inventory.
There we go.
All right.
Yeah. Let's do some science news.
Here's your Science on the March, brought to you by Squires Electric. You can find them at 503-252-1609 or squireselectric.com. You can also go to facebook.com/Squires Electric. While you're there, please click the like button if you would. And so forth. Here's a question about Facebook. They don't have a, like, there's no dislike button. There's no thumbs down, is there?
Sadly, no. Many people have asked for it, but
okay.
No.
In any event, so click the like button if you would. You can read unsolicited testimonials from satisfied customers, people who've had Squire's Electric come to their home or their business and do the installation, the upgrade, the repair, or get them ready for their next inspection. You can get a free estimate up front, of course, so you know exactly what it's going to cost you. You know you can reckon within reason exactly what it's going to be for your budget. And they are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors, which means they're going to do it right. And they're going to do it right the first time. They are proud sponsors of Science on the March here at Legion of News, Squires Electric.
The intensity of a glowworm's eerie light is controlled in part by a particular nitrogen-containing compound called octopamine, according to scientists at the University of Queensland in Australia. The worms, carnivorous larvae of the fly Arachnocampa flava, no relation to Flava Flav, I assume, dangle from cave ceilings like strings of luminescent beads. Evidence suggests that the worm's shine, which lures flying insects to a sticky death, was actively repressed during the day. Now experiments have included feeding the glowworms flies laced with different compounds suggest that octopamine plays a central role in releasing the worm's light. This was reported in the October 1st Journal of Experimental Biology. The Federal Food and Drug Administration and a leading doctor are disputing suggestions by television show host Dr. Mehmet Oz that trace amounts of arsenic in many apple juice products pose a health concern.
Oh, yeah. No, they're taking him out to lunch. I've been following this for the better part of the last week. I like to see anyone associated. I love Oprah herself. Mm-hmm. I detest everyone that sort of orbits around her.
Yeah, Dr. Phil, Dr. Oz, all of these people are just...
I don't know what it is. It's like, as much as I really do like and respect Oprah, everybody, like all of the experts she has in her show, they just rankle me, every single one of them. So I love to see any of those guys excoriated.
Oz said on his show Wednesday that testing by a New Jersey lab has found what he implied are troubling levels of arsenic in many juices. However, the FDA says lab methods are not appropriate and that its own tests show much lower arsenic levels. The agency warned the Dr. Oz show producers in advance that their testing was misleading. Dr. Richard Besser, a pediatrician and former acting head of the Centers for Disease Control, also scolded Oz on Thursday on ABC's Good Morning America for scaring consumers with what Besser called an extremely irresponsible report, like yelling fire in a movie theater. The issue, arsenic is naturally present in water, air, food, and soil in organic and inorganic forms, according to the FDA. The agency says organic arsenic is essentially harmless. It passes through the body quickly. Inorganic arsenic is the type found in pesticides, and consuming it at high levels or over a long period can cause concern. The testing the Dr. Oz show did was for total arsenic, and the FDA even disputes those levels. The agency's own tests found lower total arsenic from one of the same juice batches the show's lab tested. The statement says, there is no evidence of any public health risk from drinking these juices, and FDA has been testing them for years. They are talking, of course, again, a note, they're talking about organic and inorganic arsenic, not organic versus non-organic fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, they weren't drawing any distinction between the two in his testing, which is the problem, because, like, they'll sell, like, if you go to, like places where they sell, like, I don't know, like, camping food and trail mix and crap, like, they'll sell you bags of dried apple seeds, and there is a little warning, I think, that they're required to put on the back that says if you eat a big bag of dried apple seeds, like, you're eating arsenic, but it's a minute amount, and it goes right through you.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing is that a lot of things actually have organically bound arsenic in things like kelp that are used as fillers, but, again, it's organic, it flows right through you, it doesn't go into your bloodstream, it doesn't affect you at all, and it doesn't accumulate in any way. So, Tim Sullivan, a spokesman for Oz's show, sent an email saying, "We don't think the show is irresponsible. We think the public has a right to know what's in their foods." Sullivan said Oz does not agree that organic arsenic is as safe as authorities believe, and that the show will do further tests to distinguish organic from inorganic arsenic in juice samples. He said, "The position of the show is that the total arsenic needs to be lower. We did the tests, we stand by the results, and we think the standards should be different."
Well, all right.
So there you go.
I don't really live my life according to the teachings of Dr. Oz anyway, no. So it has negligible effect on me.
Honestly, if I wouldn't know that he actually said anything unless it showed up in the news.
Thomas Gill has noted that kelp is used in sherbet.
Yes, it is.
Really?
Kelp is used as a, agar comes from, you'll see agar as a thickening agent in a lot of foods, and that is derived from kelp.
Kelp is one of your better words. There's nothing about it that seems aesthetically pleasing, but when you say it, it just sounds good. Kelp.
Kelp.
All right.
Help. University of Pennsylvania doctors have used gene therapy to train a patient's own immune system to kill leukemia cells. The New York Times reports that doctors gutted and reconstructed a disabled form of HIV-1 by selecting DNA from humans, mice, and cows, a virus that infects woodchucks and one that infects cows. The virus infects T cells, a white blood cell that fights viruses and tumors, and alters the T cells to reproduce chimeric antigen receptors, or CARs, C-A-R-S, protein complexes that transform the cells into, quote, serial killers. The T cells recognize cancer, attack it, multiply, and continue to live on after the eradication of the cancer, patrolling the body to defend against relapses.
Wait, so this is like Alien versus Predator, but it's AIDS versus cancer inside your body?
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, except that it means you've got cancer and AIDS in your body, but I mean, you know, but it sounds like maybe it's the good kind of AIDS.
Well, yeah, it's a different kind of AIDS.
Sorry.
Yeah.
There's probably no good kind of AIDS as such. I'll be quiet.
Well, if it's killing cancer,
I guess
it's like Blade. He's still a vampire, but he's a good guy.
The enemy of my cancer is my friend.
Right.
Sort of a, okay.
Doctors first tried the experimental treatment on William Ludwig, then a 65-year-old retired corrections officer from Bridgeton, New Jersey. Researchers passed Ludwig's blood through a machine that removed about a billion T cells before returning the blood back into his veins. The removed T cells were introduced to the HIV virus, which infected and genetically transformed Ludwig's T cells. Then they were temporarily frozen. After chemotherapy to deplete any remaining T cells that may have impeded the growth of the altered ones, the new T cells were infused back into Ludwig's blood. Dr. Carl June, head of the research team, explains that the patient then becomes a bioreactor.
Awesome.
After 10 days, as the T cells reproduced, Ludwig began shaking with chills, his temperature spiked, and his blood pressure dropped dangerously. The T cells were producing chemicals called cytokines that cause flu-like symptoms. After a few weeks, the symptoms were gone, and with them, the leukemia.
I want to have Mr. T cells in my body.
Well, it's just sort of amazing, though. The doctors estimated the treatment killed about 2 pounds of cancer cells in his blood.
I don't like the idea that I would have 2 pounds of cancer cells in me, from the get-go. You think of cancers being, I mean, you don't like the idea that they're being, you know, just a huge bushel of cancer floating around inside you.
No.
This is also a story that is probably especially frustrating for anybody who has cancer, because we'll get stories like this where they say, and, you know, the experimental technique killed 98% of his cancer. The FDA says within 70 years it could be available for treatment.
Right. The guy, by the way, they aren't saying that he's cured, but it's a year later, and he's still going strong.
Yeah, so. but it's been a year, and, you know, it'll be another 10 years, and it'll still be in testing before actually allow anybody to use it.
Oh, yeah. But it's still interesting. But, yeah. No, it's whoever you are right here, even if you don't have cancer yet, it's not going to be around in time to save you.
You won't be able to use that.
If you have grandchildren, maybe and one of them gets cancer when they're in their 70s, they might get to use this. A warming climate is likely to wipe out spring-run Chinook salmon in at least one California watershed by the end of the century, according to a new study. No matter which climate projections the researchers used, warmer waters spelled major trouble for the fish in the coming decades if people knew nothing to help them. And the findings are likely to apply to a variety of salmon species up and down the West Coast, especially in California, where temperatures are closest to the tipping point. Lisa Thompson, a fisheries biologist at the University of California, Davis, said, "I saw the results almost a year ago, and I just sat at my desk and cried. Fish weren't making it through to the end of the century in almost all the cases."
Oh, honestly. Get back to work. Quit your crying and get back to your computer.
She's a fisheries biologist. She cares about the fish. She's sad that it's going to kill, that all the fish are going to die.
Here's the thing. Don't cry about something that might happen 89 years from now. Why don't you fix things that are going wrong now?
Well, they're going to try. That's the thing. First you find out that something terrible is happening, and then you try to figure out how you can head it off now so that you don't lose all this.
Just say there's no way to head it off?
They said that unless people do something.
Okay, well, that's
fish.
Not going to happen. I can just tell you that. Let me just skip to the end of the chapter. Man does nothing. The end. So get back to work.
More than a million spring-run Chinook used to live in the waters of Central Valley. Today, there are fewer than 10,000 of them, a decline of 99%. To find out what the future holds for the fish that have managed to hang on, the researchers created a model that factored in all sides of climate data, including rainfall, temperatures, humidity, and wind. They included lots of field data about how the fish respond to various conditions in their summer streams, and to focus just on the effects of freshwater conditions, they assumed the fish did just fine in the ocean and returned to their usual streams to spawn. The study considered six possible scenarios for the future, including business as usual, in which our greenhouse gas emission rates continue to rise at their current rate. The study also considered the possibility that emissions would level off by the end of the century. In all of the scenarios, even the most hopeful ones, spring run Chinook failed to survive to the year 2099.
So there you go. Nothing to be done. So I would say at this point, any more time and energy spent worrying about it is just wasted. The moral is eat salmon now because they're not going to be here, you know, within 90 years or something. Seriously,
so,
I come to work
and... So the thing is, 90 years, you will be able to get AIDS to fight your cancer, but you won't be able to get a nice plate of salmon.
Exactly. So it's a trade-off, you know, balance in all things. Seriously, I go to work and I see somebody just, you know, sitting there crying. That's somebody who's going to get some docked pay.
Why are you looking at me?
I'm just saying. No crying in salmon research.
That's sad. Ford's newest concept car, which it's introducing this week at the Frankfurt Motor Show in Germany, will be more than a driving machine, Rick Emerson. It will be a cloud computing device as well. The Evos is one of the first from a major manufacturer that will store data on and retrieve it from the internet. So-called cloud computing capabilities are already employed by Flickr, Facebook, and Google to store photos, messages, and documents on the internet, but lately the trend has been spreading to less data-driven business, and car companies are not to be excluded. An internet-connected vehicle could provide benefits to its driver by accessing the web to scan weather and traffic reports in real time in order to suggest routes, warn of accidents ahead, or even alter the suspension and handling to fit the road conditions. A rainy, wet road might require more responsive steering, for example. Such a car could also keep drivers safe. Mark Schirmer of Ford said, "We're working with some German engineers. The car could monitor a driver's heartbeat and see if he's stressed and whether or not it's a heart attack. The car could then call for help." Then there are more mundane tasks like accessing an iTunes music library or a Pandora radio account. While some of the functions can be done by a self-contained computer under the dashboard, building an internet car can reduce the cost of the design, said the company's director of electrical and electronic systems. The company can rely on industry standards, such as those for Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, already present for internet-enabled devices, instead of spending money on research and development for specialized systems that are manufacturer-specific. This also allows for driving-centered smartphone apps that interact with your car. The fellow says, "The signs continue to say that your phone is going to be the center of your connectivity. As more cars come online, they'll be able to speak to each other, even if they aren't from the same manufacturer. More cars online will no doubt lead to more data than application developers can be able to use." Robin Chase, founder of the car sharing company Zipcar and also Buzzcar, said, for example, "The efficiency of many hybrid cars depends on what kind of driver you are. Do you do long trips, short ones, in between? How fast do you go? Without that data, it's a lot harder to decide which one to buy." And he says, "Right now, all my data is stuck in my car. When you upload it to the cloud, you can manipulate it in all sorts of interesting ways."
It's all well and good until that green goblin truck starts, you know, radicalizing all the other vehicles on the road.
Is it just like Amazon uses data from millions of people to track purchasing habits? The automotive data might be able to tell traffic planners how people actually drive and alter how roads get built and where. So, looking for the internet car. And I had something else, didn't I? Yes. Well, yes. The federal government is gaining control over an even larger expanse of rainbow-colored petrified wood, fossils from the dawning age of dinosaurs, and petroglyphs left by American Indian tribes who once lived in eastern Arizona. The National Park Service secured the first major private ranch within the Petrified Forest National Park boundaries on Thursday, capping off negotiations that began years ago with the help of a conservation group.
What is a petroglyph?
Mr. Gill? I believe they're...
I feel like I'm a teacher. Don't look at Thomas Gill for the answer.
It's rock art, cave art.
What's a hieroglyph?
Hieroglyph, I believe, I think that... God damn it.
I mean... Not like I know. I mean, I have no idea either.
Thomas might be right. I think it's hieroglyphs are drawn, petroglyphs are carved in.
Okay, all right.
Okay, or vice versa.
Are you doing the lumbata over there? What are you doing? Oh, okay, he was doing it.
Oh, he just did a little dance.
Okay.
We need a video camera in here. The opportunity, let's see, scientists say they're eager to explore more than 26,000 acres that have remained largely untouched and discover even more treasures. Bill Parker, a paleontologist at the park, said the opportunity to actually go out into an area that hasn't been worked before by other researchers, the opportunity to find things that are truly new to science, there's a very good chance of that, and it's pretty exciting. I think we're definitely going to be able to find some things that are new out there that are really going to enhance the story of the park. Congress expanded the boundaries of the park in 2004 from 93,500 acres to about 218,000 acres, but did not immediately appropriate any money to buy the private holdings. The funding for land purchases came years later through a federal land protection program. They've now acquired a third of the 120,000 acres at once, with the most significant acreage coming from the transfer of a BLM land and Thursday's $8 million purchase of the Pulsal Ranch within the park's boundaries. So, yeah, they're going to be doing an inventory of the land before they decide how the public can best do it. Apparently, some 630,000 people visit the Petrified Forest every year.
Apparently, so the difference is petroglyphs are caused by carving into or excising sections of rock. And so that has to do with the method. Hieroglyphs have to do with the content. They are of animals or people and usually sacred in nature.
Ah.
So one is content, one is manner.
Well, thank
I
you,
guess.
Smart person, other than Thomas Gill, who apparently didn't know.
That's Nabuni who said that.
Well, thank you, Nabuni.
So there you go. Thank you, Nabuni.
That's all of our science.
There you go. There's your Science on the March, brought to you by Squires Electric. Call them at 503-252-1609 or call Squires. Rather, you can go online to squireselectric.com or facebook.com/Squires Electric. They are the proud sponsors of Science on the March here at Legion of News. Coming up here in a few minutes, we get your entertainment news in the next hour of the Rick Emerson radio program at rickemersonshow.com. Today, Job Watch and more. Here is Don Taylor.
A group of Kentucky Amish men would prefer to do jail time rather than violate their religious beliefs, which they say forbids the placement of bright orange safety triangles on the backs of their buggies. The orange triangles are required on all slow-moving vehicles, according to Kentucky state law. Nine men in the western part of the state have refused to use them. They belong to the Old Order Schwarzentruber Amish. According to court documents, this sect follows a strict code of conduct called Ordnung, which regulates everything from hairstyle and dress to education and transportation. They believe the displays of loud colors should be avoided, along with the use of worldly symbols. Schwarzentruber Amish believe such symbols indicate the user no longer trusts fully in God. The Schwarzentruber Amish use reflective tape, but refuse to use the orange triangle. After the appeal of their 2008 conviction was denied, Menno Zook, Danny Beiler, Mose Yoder, Levi Hoptetler, David Zook, and
You're
Eli Zook.
You're making up all of these names, as well as the name of the sect itself. Like, what are they, Schnitzengruben or something?
Schwarzentruber.
Schwarzentruber.
Yeah. Mose Yoder and Eli Zook.
15 is my limit on Schwarzentruber.
They refuse to pay the small fines associated with their conviction. All six are currently serving sentences ranging from 3 to 10 days in the Graves County Jail. Two other men, Jacob Gingerich and Emmanuel Yoder, have already served their sentences and been released. The men, say the county police chief, are very polite, respectful, everything you would expect. He said the men dressed up in their Sunday best to report for their jail sentences. The men are not forced to wear the Orange County jail uniforms. They are allowed to wear uniforms that are dyed a dark gray, but they are not allowed to wear their own clothes. The ninth man, Levi Zook, had his fine paid by John Vaya, a Graves County resident who has close ties among the Amish community. He said he paid the fine because Levi Zook has a son with cerebral palsy. Said, the Lord just put it on me. It was bothering me too much. I know the problems in that area.
I like to think that if Amish guys have to go to prison, that they'd be badasses somehow. That if they were just, you know, that anybody crossed them, they would just, you know, them down.
Oh, yeah. They don't. They know how to wield a scythe.
Yeah, I would.
They could take you out.
You know, that they don't, you know, that they don't want to use violence. But if pushed, they can just level a brother.
Vaya says there's another problem with the orange triangle for the Schwarzentruber Amish. The triangle is the symbol of the Holy Trinity, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost. Schwarzentruber Amish believed in the unity of God, says Vaya, which motivates their refusal to use the symbol, in addition to other reasons. In their appeal, the men argued not only that Kentucky law violated their freedom of religious expression, but that the law has been selectively applied against the Schwarzentruber Amish. In an assessment with which Vaya and his wife agree, both questioned why the men were not allowed to wear their plain Amish clothes in jail when other arrested people are allowed to wear their own clothing. People around here feel sorry for them, said Vaya's wife. Maya points out the Schwartz and Truber Amish use a high quality reflective tape on their buggies, along with lanterns and red reflector lights. They are trying to comply with the law without violating their religious beliefs. But he says the men see this as a battle over religious expression. They don't want the fines paid. They want to serve their sentences.
It's so hard to be angry at the Amish.
Yeah.
I mean, I should be, but it's difficult to sustain any sort of irritation at them for some reason. They're just so cute.
They're adorable, and they make great furniture.
You're thinking of Quakers.
Amish make good furniture, too.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I know they make clothing.
They also make excellent furniture.
What kind of furniture?
Wooden furniture.
Cabinets
and
like
tables.
Like an armoire of some kind?
Chairs and such. Yeah, you can get an armoire.
All right, then.
And they make them all without using power tools. So everything is very, very finely joined by hand.
Well, that's the whole thing with Quaker furniture, too, is that Quaker furniture actually doesn't use... Quaker furniture will blow your mind because they don't... Not only do they not use power tools, they don't use any screws, nails, or glue. It just, like, magically snaps together and then never comes apart because the power of Christ, like, holds the shelf in or something.
Like Legos.
Yeah, it is. It's a little freaky, actually. You can't think about it too much.
Officials with the CDC have linked an outbreak of listeria to cantaloupes grown in the Rocky Ford region of Colorado. Cantaloupe farmer Kent Lusk said farming the fruit is critical to the area's economy, and he worries about the damage being done to the industry's image.
Well, I already made my Def Leppard joke about this.
You sang listeria.
Well, there was that.
Yesterday.
I was going to do something else. Doesn't matter. What's this, contamination?
Yes.
It is the image. And it's... And that...
What the hell? Say it again.
It is the image. And it's...
It's something about the image. I think you're talking about...
It is the image. And that does frighten us a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, no idea.
Cantaloupe farmer Paul Casper says food preparation is key.
It came from an outside source somewhere other than the cantaloupe.
From space.
That infected the outer shell. That's why I'm saying this could happen anywhere.
Oh, God.
It came from an outside... It came from somewhere where things ain't as they is here.
Yeah.
Okay.
So... I don't know where to go with that. It's cantaloupe.
Cantaloupe are funny.
Yeah.
It's just, you know. Hey, I know I've asked this before. Cucumbers. Yeah. Are they melons?
I don't know.
They're a member of some. Are they squash?
They're closer to squash.
They're not melons. They're squash. Okay. All right.
Because they grow on vines.
All right.
Yeah.
Cucumbers, squash.
But then again, so do melons.
Okay. Well, never mind. I give up.
What do you mean? Of course, they grow on vines.
What do they kind of do? They don't...
Because we thought, they kind of... Yeah,
well,
melons are kind of on vines.
In a manner of speaking.
There certainly aren't squash vines, my opinion.
Now, Laura and I are having this whole thing about... We were making some a cucumber dish last night. We were having this whole thing about whether cucumbers were squash or not, and I couldn't quite remember.
Because they are kind of zucchini-like.
That's the thing. I was trying to remember if they were the same thing as zucchini in terms of their family or whatever, but it doesn't really matter.
All right. Let's do our entertainment news.
Here is your entertainment news for Thursday, September 15th, 2011.
Michael Jackson's estate has generated more than $310 million in the 2 years since the pop singer died deeply in debt, enabling executors to distribute a preliminary payment of $30 million to Jackson's mother and children and to unnamed charities, according to a recently filed court document. Executors also disclosed Tuesday that Jackson's mother, Catherine, is putting the family's fabled Encino compound up for sale and wants the executors to negotiate the purchase of a new residence for her and the children, Paris, Prince, and Michael Joseph Jr., known as Blanket. I thought his name was legally Blanket. Sad to know that he's just called Blanket.
No, I think Blanket is his nickname.
The Encino property, where Jackson grew up and where several of his siblings lived in a cottage near their parents' home, was appraised at $4.15 million in 2010, but has since undergone extensive renovation. Catherine Jackson and the children moved out and have been living at a leased Calabasas home that is for sale for about $10 million. The executor said Catherine Jackson has identified a number of homes in that price range that would suit her needs and that of the children. Must be nice to be just shopping around looking for something in the $10 million range that will do.
Well, anything else is just, that would be showy.
The executor said the trust and the California Attorney General's office, which is representing charities as beneficiaries of the estate, have been pressing for distribution of the funds. The executors, John Branca and John McClain. John McClain? Don't screw with him. They filed a detailed accounting of finances since Jackson's death on June 25th, 2009. By the end of last year, the estate had produced more than $310 million in gross revenues. Since that date, the estate assets have continued to generate additional income, according to the executives. Henry Winkler, the actor best known for his work on the sitcom Happy Days, has been made an honorary member of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire for his work for helping children with dyslexia. British Ambassador Nigel Sheinwald presented the award to Winkler at the Washington Embassy on Wednesday. Winkler's dyslexia was diagnosed as an adult. He has toured schools in Britain in the last 2 years to talk about the condition and has written books about Hank Zipser, a boy with dyslexia.
Okay.
Winkler says he's flattered to have his work recognized and added he hoped to continue showing kids that their learning difficulty isn't a disability.
Is he himself dyslexic?
Did
I miss this? Okay. And what was the name of the children's...
The character is named Hank Zipser.
Hank Zipser. Is that something backward? Or is that... Is that a...
No,
is there a significance to the name?
I think it's like it's a his own sort of... Because he's Henry Winkler, and this is Hank Zipser.
Okay.
And the kid has dyslexia, and so you kind of figure Zipser would be a tough name if you have dyslexia.
Here's the thing that happens in my life for what some reason.
Thomas Gill is calling Henry Winkler right now.
Every single time that I find out someone I know is dyslexic, it's always immediately after I've made fun of them for not being able to read something properly or making some sort of a reading mistake.
What's wrong with you?
Yeah, seriously, what's up with your eyes? Why can't you read correctly? I'm dyslexic. Oh, and I'm always, I've done that like three different times, like in the last couple of years. I'll mock somebody and then it turns out they're dyslexic and then I feel like an ass.
I can't remember the actual technical term for it at the moment, but I have math dyslexia that I have some of the same problems that dyslexics have, except I have them with numbers that I transpose numbers and math itself is just completely alien to me. It makes no sense. And so it's like, you know, I will make jokes about like math is hard, but the thing is, for me, math really is hard. And I'll get crap from people sometimes about not being able to do simple division in my head. So I just kind of like, yeah, well, I'm math dyslexic, so screw you. It doesn't seem really sound the same.
No, it lacks punch.
TV icon TV icon Sam Simon, who co-created The Simpsons, claims the people who run Pinkberry, the yogurt places, are liars who bilked his charity to make a quick buck. Simon claims he was looking to buy property in L.A. to operate a nonprofit food bank to benefit needy families earlier this year when his realtor found a Pinkberry yogurt shop. In the lawsuit filed in L.A. County Superior Court, Simon says the place seemed like a good fit. It had a walk-in freezer, a food prep area, and other things, so he bought the place for $1.2 million in February. Simon claims the Pinkberry people swore the place was permitted for food product operations, but after he took possession of the property, Simon claims he learned it was all a lie. In the documents, Simon says Pinkberry never obtained permits for the plumbing, mechanical, electrical, and certain food handling appliances. But worst of all, Sam says the place was only licensed to be an automobile repair garage and was never approved for food service.
Those are two very different... Yeah, that's not like a... Like you transpose two lines on the application or something.
Yeah, he's now suing his realtor and Pinkberry co-founder Shelley Huang and the company through which Pinkberry does business, claiming they all should pay for all of his costs to bring the place up to code and damages.
Okay.
The British rapper who paid $37,500 for the very first pair of the Back to the Future Nike shoes says that he never, ever plans to wear them.
Also, they don't self-lace.
No, they don't.
They're just cosplay shoes, as somebody noted.
Yeah.
That's all they are. They don't self-lace. They're just...
No.
They're just big, spongy Nikes.
And I sent you the link to that thing about somebody saying how they could have actually made that,
Well,
right?
They have a patent on self-lacing.
Yeah.
Nike owns a patent on self-lacing shoes. These shoes for this... Now, they may be unveiling in the future shoes that self-lace. The shoes in this particular promotion are just shoes with lights on them.
Yeah, they just look like the shoes.
That's all they do.
Well, there were 1,500 pairs. They were put on eBay for auction with the money going to Michael J. Fox's Foundation for Parkinson's Research. The very first pair to just get bought went for $37,500 to a British rapper named Tinny Tempa. He was leaving a baseball event in New York last night when he told he was asked about the Nikes. He said not only, yes, he planned to display them and never wear them, but he also said that he is currently shipped them en route to Michael J. Fox to sign them for him. So, and all the money from the auction is going to Michael J. Fox's foundation, which is kind of cool. Okay. This is a very, very weird story. The White House gatecrasher couple?
Yes.
Tarek and Michaela Salahi. Apparently, she is now on Real Housewives of D.C. Tarek reported that Michaela was missing on Tuesday. and said that she had been kidnapped. She, however, was eventually found, says she's fine. The sheriff's office, Warren County Sheriff's Office, said they had spoken to her on Wednesday, and she assured the deputy she'd left the residence with a good friend and was where she wanted to be. Mrs. Salahi advised she did not want Mr. Salahi to know where she was. Where she was in Tennessee with Journey guitarist Neil Sean, with whom she is having an affair. They're playing a show with Foreigner. And so she had gone to Tennessee to shtup the guy from Journey.
If you had stopped this story halfway through, like before you got to the end and asked me to fill in the rest of it, I would have been here for an infinity.
Yeah.
I would have been here for a multitude of years before I ever would have gotten to Neil Sean as the guy, you know, was having an affair with blank.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have gone, you know, to like Ben Stein before I got to Neil Sean.
Yeah. And then the capper sentence at the end of the story, nobody kidnapped her and they are in Memphis together, a Journey rep told TMZ.
Go figure. What, was he just like flipping it around on the television one day? And he, well, that looks good. Get me one of those. Well, all right.
I know. At what point did their paths cross?
Yeah, I have no idea. That's bizarre.
America's Got Talent came down to an eclectic mix of four acts last night to win $1 million and get their own headlining Las Vegas act. The ultimate winner was jazz singer Landau Eugene Murphy Jr., who went from washing cars and living on the street to performing in front of millions. The newly minted millionaire, who once struggled to support his family, previously told People magazine he planned to take his earnings and invest it in my kids' futures. He narrowly beat out the Silhouettes, who had the show's youngest contestant to date. That group wowed judges all season long by posing behind a screen and making shapes with their bodies that matched famous photographs that were typically American-themed.
What?
I don't watch the show, so I don't know what that
okay.
means. Also in the top four were Team Illuminate, a glow-in-the-dark dance act whose choreography skills combined with unique presentation made them a fan favorite, and Pop Life, P-O-P-L-Y-F-E. Piers Morgan originally told the young Oakland, California-based band that all of its members, except for their frontwoman, were essentially useless. But after weeks of wowing all three judges with iconic songs by the Beatles and Jackson 5, Morgan took back his original critique.
This might make more sense if I had ever watched the show, if I paid any attention at all.
I can't watch it mainly because of the backstage nonsense with Nick Cannon, because he stands backstage and like chats up the people, and he is so phenomenally irritating and not funny.
Is he obsequious? Is that his thing, or is it?
He's just terrible. He's just not charismatic. I guess he's a comedian, and he tries to be funny, but he's not. And he's terrible. Originally, when they did the show, Jerry Springer was the guy standing backstage and talking to the people.
See, that would,
and that was cool.
I'd watch that.
I actually watched a few episodes when he did it. But with Nick Cannon, is just a horrible. He's just irritating as hell.
He's a wholly loathsome individual.
He pretty much is, yeah. Netflix has lowered its expectations for U.S. subscribers for the third quarter by 4% on Thursday, just weeks after separating its DVD and streaming services, which increased the price for customers who want both.
Also, they're going to take it in the shorts because Starz is going to sever their service. And Starz is who they get a lot of their on-demand stuff from.
Yes. The news sent the online movie rental company's shares down more than 14% in midday trading. The company, which split its streaming and DVD services 2 months ago, now expects a total of 24 million subscribers in the third quarter, down from the 25 million it had forecast in July. It expects 21.8 million people to subscribe to its streaming service, either with or without also getting DVDs in the mail. That is down from an expected 22 million that it forecast earlier. And they expect 14.2 million people to subscribe to the DVD rental service with or without streaming, and that's down from their forecast of 15 million. The company said that despite the lowered subscriber guidance, it thinks the split was the right move. He said, while Netflix leadership in online streaming should remain uncontested for a long time, he thinks a combination of the recent price hike, a less favorable competitive environment, and aggressive international expansion raises the risk profile of the split.
I think Netflix is now basically like TiVo. They're one of those companies that is just hoping to remain profitable long enough for somebody larger to buy them. That's you know, like, you know, in fact, the other day when we were, you know, with the Apple store, Thomas and I were talking about that whole thing that has floated around for years and years that Apple ought to just flat out buy TiVo. Because TiVo has just had, they've never really made a lot of money. They just had a hell of a time being profitable. For a device that everybody loves, they just can't seem to scrape out much of a profit. And at this point, their best bet is just to be purchased by somebody before, you know, Microsoft and that, like, Xbox Diamond thing or whatever comes out and just eats their lunch.
And Apple TV, while ostensibly a good product, that never took off. So, they should just buy TiVo and have that
and
be the thing.
That's the thing with Netflix, because everybody like Amazon and Microsoft and Apple are all in this arms race to provide streaming content from the cloud to people. And Netflix is kind of doing that. They've owned that one niche. And so it just seems like whoever buys them is going to instantly have, you know, huge name recognition, if nothing else. So we've got 12 seconds. We'll just...
I got nothing.
Just do a whole... Wait, I just... I'm... Yes?
I would like to thank Mr. Robert Wagner.
Can't hear you, Don.
I want to thank Robert Wagner for the shout-out on Portland Sucks this morning. He played an excerpt from Ham-Fisted Radio on his show this morning.
Did he?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
And it was delightful.
All right, then. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And with that, we bring down the curtain on this another exciting episode of Legion of News. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, hive of the Milkpacking District in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. The news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. Thank you for listening. We will see you again tomorrow at noon. That is Friday at noon for another episode of Legion of News. We'll see you next hour at RickEmersonShow.com. And we'll see you tomorrow at noon. You can get this program as well via iTunes or a direct MP3 download here at Cascadia.fm or LegionofNews.com. Have a safe and satisfying Thursday, won't you? We'll be right back.